We will move into item number three, which is the director's report. So, Director Unsworth, I will hand it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, we have several items today to update folks on, and as I traditionally do, it'll be a bit of a tag team, but so I'm going to start out. Joe has a license sales and other report here in a little while, but first I want to start out by introducing a new member of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Jim Woods. Jim has come to us as our tribal liaison, and he's helping us with interactions with tribes and other policy issues. And Jim, why don't you introduce yourself and tell folks a little bit about your background and how you and I have been working together. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, we've been to several. Jim's introduced me and helped me at several venues recently, and it's really been great to have Jim on board.
Yeah. Good morning, commissioners and colleagues. So my name is Jim Woods. I'm a member of the Macaw tribe on the Olympic Peninsula, and I've been working with tribes here in Washington State for most all my career. I formerly served a White House appointment with the former presidential administration at the Environmental Protection Agency as a senior tribal policy advisor. Prior to that, I worked a detail under the Bush administration for 1 year as well under their authorities with the Environmental Protection Agency. And I worked for the Macaw tribe in Macaw Fisheries Management, and where I developed the environmental programs there. So it's quite an honor to be here, a part of this agency, and here in Washington to be able to work with the department and the tribes that I know very well. So it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Welcome. And being a former EPA guy myself, it's nice to see you. Another colleague out there.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And please feel free to contact Jim if you have any questions about any tribal issues. It's been really helpful so far for the department. And he's found himself very busy just answering questions from all the different programs. So anyway, welcome aboard. The next item I'd like to touch on is a legislative report. Raquel, if you'll come up. The legislature has started. They've been here on a work session. Nate Pamplin and I gave a presentation on our progress on meeting the directives in the proviso that came along with last year's budget. We have a couple pieces of legislation that will be in the mix this year, as well as some budget items, and so Raquel's going to give a quick update on those items.
Good morning, commissioners. So we've got exactly 1 month to go until the legislative session starts on January 8th. And just here to pump you guys up just a little bit in advance. We had committee assembly, as Jim mentioned, just a couple weeks ago. We had three work sessions, one on the budget proviso, one on net pens, and one on the Ruckels House recreational access assessment. And we participated in all of those, had some really good questions from the legislature that we got to have some good dialogue around all those issues. When they were in town, the legislature also settled on committee assignments. No major changes in the House, but in the Senate, with the change in leadership, we do have new committee chairs and new committee structures. So the Natural Resources and Parks Committee, which is where most of our bills go through, is going to include ag and water now as well, and will be chaired by Senator Kevin Vandeweghe, who's from Squim, Washington. And the Ways and Means Committee will be chaired by Senator Christine Rolfes from Bainbridge Island. And then we've got our two agency request bills moving forward. We got approval from the governor's office to advance those. And as you'll recall, that's the ADA technical change bill and the hunter-fisher recruitment bill. We're also getting a lot of questions from the governor's office around our 9 budget requests. They asked us to submit some additional fiscal information for a couple of other decision packages, an orca whale recovery package, and a wildlife trafficking decision package. So just heads up that we may see those items funded in the governor's budget as well.
and we're going to likely see the governor's budget out mid-December. Then you heard Commissioner Graybill talk about this guide proviso work. We had our last meeting last night, and the staff's now trying to turn and burn pretty quickly a report to the legislature that's due December 31st. So we'll get that to you as soon as it's complete. We also had the commercial bill move through pretty quickly at the end of session last year, and some technical fixes need to be made on the non-resident rates. We've got a couple of legislators that are really interested in helping us make some adjustments so we can max out commercial non-resident rates and use the savings towards the license types that have had an increase most recently. So guides, resident guides rates are of interest to them in adjusting, maybe bringing them down just a little bit. And then next year is a 60-day supplemental session. The legislature hasn't completed their work on time in many years, but there's a lot of optimism that they're going to complete on time this year because they've got campaigning to do for the big election year next year. That being said, there's a lot of really, really big natural resource issues on the agenda. There's the Hearst water decision. They've got to come in probably in the first week of session and resolve that and hopefully pass the capital budget. There's a big push for orca whale and salmon recovery this legislative session. There's a lot of interest in doing some additional regulatory oversight around net pens. There's talks of a carbon tax. And a real need to address some of the issues around the court's rejection of their McCleary education fix. So I think it's going to be a really exciting, really aggressive, action-packed 60 days. Any questions for me?
Questions? You mentioned the capital budget, which we expect is probably going to be taken care of in the early days of the session. Since there has been no capital budget, how, and some of those funds have timing attached to them, how can we have sort of a broad brush overview of how we're impacted by that?
So I should probably get back to you with more information, but I can say we've been working as hard as we can to keep people on and keep them on other projects that still have work to be done. We can't keep them on much longer than February, March, and that's the same case with a lot of other agencies. So we're really pushing the legislature to get a capital passed in as early in session as possible.
Well, aside from people, capital purchases, where grants had timing, and that, are we impacted by any of that? Are we going to lose the opportunity to complete some land purchases or some...
That, and there's also a lot of fear about the federal budget and overlays there. Joe, did you have...
Yeah, Commissioner Thorburn, maybe I can add some detail. So we have just under 100 people out of our 1,600, 1,700 that are whose salaries come primarily from capital dollars. Don't hold me to this exactly, but about 20 of those folks are supported by capital dollars that come over from other agencies, and they're working on things like the Chehalis water study, culverts, those kinds of projects. And so far, as Raquel said, we've been able to keep those people that were here permanently on until probably around March. We've had about a half a dozen staff in the Chehalis project who we would have extended. They were on temporary positions. We probably would have extended them if the capital budget had passed. We weren't able to do that, so those jobs ended in September. And then the rest of those folks, about 80 or so, are in our capital program. And again, we received about $52 million in reappropriation dollars. So we were able to keep those people engaged and productive, but only till about March. In terms of impacts on the ground, we didn't turn to our capital list and start constructing those projects that we had proposed because we didn't get funding. And instead, again, we worked on some of the projects that we started last biennium and moved forward past the design and permitting stage in some cases. the land acquisition side, the WWRP program, again, wasn't funded, and we had, I think, either four or five projects that were likely that were likely to have been funded if the capital budget had passed, and those are on hold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. A question about the guide limitation matter that you spoke of. So in the transboundary areas of the Columbia River with the state of Oregon, there are a lot of Oregon fishing guides, and the license fee in Oregon is pretty inexpensive. In these considerations, is there now any consideration for coordination with Oregon relative to guide limitation reciprocity?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. We heard that concern voiced at almost every single one of the guide meetings we held, that we're seeing a lot of guides go over to Oregon and get licenses there because we don't actually allow guides and Washington licensed guides to guide down there. So that's one of the things we're going to be capturing in the report and starting to kind of follow up on, see what that's going to take, and hopefully put some motions underway on that.
Okay, thank you, Raquel. We'll move on to a couple other issues, but yeah, the interstate guiding issues are important, really important in Idaho. Idaho really tightly regulates guide numbers by numbers of launches per day on river sections, and Washington doesn't, and there's conflicts there on the Washington part of the Snake, Washington-Idaho part of the Snake River. So a big issue and a lot of interest in part of our industry, and guides we always need to remember they're taking our customers too, so they're an important part of the mix here in Washington. Joe's going to give us an update on license sales. I think he's passed out a spreadsheet right now. We committed to doing this here a couple months ago, and we'll try to keep doing this in the future. It's interesting and certainly relevant to our day-to-day numbers.
Yeah, thanks, Director, and good morning, Commissioners. I want to touch, before I talk about the license revenue, I just wanted to give you a brief update on our diversity efforts. We have put together a 25-member internal advisory committee on diversity and inclusion. We have our first meeting scheduled for next Tuesday, December 12th, in Ellensburg, at the Central Washington University, and that'll be a meeting where we start to storm and form, start to put together charters and put together sort of rules for the group and gauge their interest in various issues. We have two executive sponsors, Margan Carlson, who's the deputy from the Habitat Program, and Amy Windrop, who's our Region 4 regional director, are going to be leading that. But again, if you remember the last time I talked with you about this, this will be primarily a self-directed group. So it'll be up to the group as to, you know, what role management has in over the long term. There's a lot of excitement. We've met in smaller groups with all 25 members, and people are pretty energized and interested and want to make the workplace here at WDFW a great place for everybody. So that's an exciting thing that's taking shape. Second thing, as the director announced, that I wanted to speak to was the charts that I just handed out. Let me orient you a little bit. Some of the commissioners have seen this in the past. These are our Wildlife Fund license revenues primarily. What you see on the page on the left-hand side in the tan, orange, blue, and green, the tan set of numbers are totals of the other three. The orange are our hunting revenues, the blue fishing revenues, and the green are other assorted revenues. And what we've done is we've compared fiscal year 18 to date. So the fiscal year started in July, and so at the end of November, these are end of November numbers, we're 5 months into the fiscal year, and we compare it to 5 months into the past 6 years. So all the way back to FY12, and we average those, and we do a one-on-one comparison between this year and last year and give you a percent increase or decrease there. On the right-hand side are the is a bar chart that summarizes all three of those categories, the hunting, fishing, and other. And you can go through and look. Remember, for fishing, for our license sales, our highest sales occur between April and June. So these figures at this point in time don't capture the highest performing quarter. But you can see that in terms of fishing, we are slightly ahead of FY17, and hunting slightly behind. 2.9% behind on hunting and about 5% ahead on fishing. 12% ahead on fishing. And then you get a sense of the other revenue sources there. We plot those out from FY18 to FY12. Then in the bottom left-hand corner, this is kind of interesting. These are individual participants. And you can see, you can compare, you know, to November of each year from FY12 to FY17 in terms of the number of participants, fishing in blue and hunting in green. And the hunting has held relatively stable over the course of those 6 years. Fishing, we've seen a drop-off in fishing a little bit here so far this year, but again, this is July to November, so not the hottest fishing months of the year necessarily. So I just wanted you to be able to take a look at that. If you have questions about that, thoughts about how we could improve that presentation, just let me know.
Yeah. Joe, and again, going back to the WAFA discussion of last year about, you know, or the Western decline in that, and it's not really all that germane, but more out of a point of curiosity. How do you know how Oregon is in, you know, percentage wise? Are we comparable, or some of our other states? I mean, the dollar figures would change, but the trends.
I don't, Commissioner. Although I suspect they're probably on the hunting side struggling like we are. It's probably fairly similar in terms of maintaining that base participation. But I don't know. We could look.
Yeah, I think this is something to discuss with WAFA and AFWA, because it was a rather alarming presentation that I heard last year. So, thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
I just want to compliment Joe for giving us these. I use these a lot throughout the year because people, you know, make some statement to me and I go, let me check. And it's really interesting to me, and so I just want to thank you, and you've done this for a bunch of years and keep doing it.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Okay, thank you. I'll move along. I wanted to let the Commission know I had an interesting opportunity in November. I was asked by AFWA, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, the National Association, to come back to D.C. and represent Western directors in a meeting with Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue to talk about a few items. The two main items were Farm Bill and National Forest Policy. It was a really neat experience. I was there with Ron Reagan, the director of AFWA, as well as Nick Wiley, the director from Florida Department of Fish and Wildlife. With Secretary Perdue, we talked about mostly Farm Bill programs and the strong support of wildlife agencies across the country for the conservation parts of the Farm Bill. Every state agency works closely with NRCS, and really some of the best examples of large-scale habitat improvements that actually result in population increases in for wildlife are a result of the Farm Bill, and that's like Conservation Reserve Program and fabulous pheasant hunting that you have in some parts of the Midwest. So it's really important to us, and they acknowledge that, and they understand that working with private landowners and these federal programs is important to all the states, and here in Washington it's extremely important too. On the national forest policy side, one of the main issues we talked about was this fire borrowing issue. Forest Service budgets are often depleted by fire, addressing forest fire issues. And so some of the areas that get shortchanged are recreation and wildlife. And so the state's proposed that maybe we fund wildfire more in a disaster relief manner instead of through the Forest Service budgets, just to make sure that we keep solid recreational and wildlife sections of the Forest Service budget. Anyway, an interesting trip. Also during that trip, I had the opportunity to attend a Fish and Wildlife Foundation meeting, and it was attended by Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke, and I had a chance to visit with him a bit, and also his Deputy Assistant Secretary Aurelia Skipwith, and that turned out to be quite an interesting contact. She had been talking to our Thurston County commissioners about Mazama's pocket gophers, which was fairly amazing that someone at that level of interior would be interested in a pocket gopher. But it gave us an opportunity to work with Aurelia, and I want to acknowledge Hannah Anderson. She did a terrific job providing great science data to the Assistant Secretary, and we had a follow-up conference call and with the Thurston County Commissioners and her, and it was interesting that Washington was getting that kind of interest and attention at that level. So we worked through the issues, and now we have some contacts in Interior. So that was an interesting trip. I wanted to mention a little bit, as long as we're talking national issues, about the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. This is the potential legislation to form a Pittman-Robertson-Dingell-Johnson-like funding at the federal level that would provide dollars for species of greatest conservation need. The legislation is pending. We're hoping it will drop next week. We've been hearing that about the last 3 weeks, but lots going on in Congress. Currently, Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska and Debbie Dingell of Michigan are sponsors of that bill. But as soon as it drops, we've already started talking to our congressionals, but we'll immediately turn up the dial and get our congressionals to take a look at the legislation and get on board. It would be an exciting piece of legislation and certainly a game changer for species that we haven't had as good a funding for as others. So that was exciting. And I sent you a summary of the AFWA, their monthly or bi-monthly report. It has some an article in there about this Recovery American Wildlife Act, and also has links to a website that would provide you with more information. There's several other good things in there, so that's worth taking a look at. The next topic I want to talk about talk a little bit about wildlife rehabilitation. And we have several rehabbers in the audience, and the first thing I want to do is acknowledge the great work that you all do, and thank you for helping the department in this very difficult issue of wildlife rehabilitation. Every year, for as long as I've been in this profession, it seems that we provide a news release to the general public and request that people leave animals alone and leave them in place. We don't seem to be able to communicate that message very well, because every year lots and lots of juvenile animals are picked up, brought to the department, and then thank goodness we have a way to deal with them, and that's to use our wildlife rehabbers to help us get these animals raised to an age where they can be released into the wild. And one of the main goals of wildlife rehab, of course, is to help these individual animals, but is to rewild them and keep them in a position or in a state where they can be released into the wild. Some of them are too injured, and we just can't do that. And animals have to be euthanized at times, but many animals are successfully returned to the wild, and it makes all of us feel good. It solves problems for the department, and it allows many of my biologists and conservation officers to do other work if they have you to help us. And so I wanted to thank you for that. Recently, we've had an issue with one of the rehabbers. For heaven's sakes, it's made the news. Our officers visit. We've had, I guess, a series of visits to that facility. We had some animals that were reported that they were habituated to humans. It was decided to remove some of those animals, and we ended up euthanizing three deer and one elk. The day was difficult, as it always is when you remove animals from anybody, not only from a rehabber, but from we sometimes find ourselves having to take animals from, for example, raccoons from individuals, other animals that they're not allowed to have or they've made into pets. And it's always difficult. It's always a challenge. And I remind my folks, it's unfortunately always an opportunity to be on the front page. And so we expect, and I expect, professionalism at all levels under those kind of operations. And I think that this most recent incident has provided us an opportunity to download, debrief, ask ourselves, did we do things right? Could we have done things differently? What's the timeline on handling these kind of issues? It's not an emergency. Can we take a breath, decide if there's a better way to do things? And I think that's the kind of review we're working on right now internally with the staff. As I said, we've had a couple of meetings with everybody that's been involved, and the idea is to put together a list of, or a checklist, if you will, of just ways that we can make sure we're covering the bases and doing everything we can to make these very difficult and uncomfortable situations go as smoothly as possible in the future. This is an emotional issue, and people are passionate. You all are very passionate about wildlife and wild things, or you wouldn't be investing the hundreds, thousands of hours that you do into helping this wildlife. And so I wanted you to know that we are working on it. We're working on self-improvements, and we're going to do what we can to continue to work with you because you're very important partners with us. So I don't think I have much more to say about that. We are working on improvements, and I think I'll be hearing from some of you here after my comments later. So, want to briefly inform the commission that we've had received a letter from the Humane Society of the United States concerned about our management of black bears that are doing damage to timber. This came up last year, and it's a continuing issue and a tough one for us. Washington is one, is actually, it's pretty interesting. I worked on black bears for my master's degree a long time ago, and one of the pieces of, at that time, there wasn't a whole lot in the literature on black bears, but one of the things in the literature was a study conducted down here on Long Beach about black bear and timber damage. And kind of an interesting aside, one of the main ways to capture black bears is with an Aldrich foot snare, and that was developed here in Washington and during that research. But probably almost 40 years ago, people were just starting to look at wildlife research, or wildlife research into black bears, and it evolved around this problem of timber management and black bears stripping bark off trees and killing trees. So it's been around, the issue's been around a long time. The department, I think back then, was very liberal in the way that they harvested black bears, and populations were reduced by 400 annually just to prevent timber damage. We've done a whole lot of work since then. And have refined our methods, worked with the timber industry to do a better job at targeting individual animals, not doing just general population reductions, but trying to figure out which specific animals are causing damage and dealing with those specific animals. And in 2014, I think we removed about 100 black bears that were causing damage, and I think more recently we're down to about 68. So we've made big progress from where we were 40 years ago, but it's still an issue. Bears are still doing damage, and we're still needing to control them. Along during that time period, of course, we saw legislation that banned bear baiting and hound use for black bears, except for under specific circumstances, to control damage problems. And we have continued to use those tools and sportsmen to help the department, not unlike rehab, but to reach out to other partners to help us take care of damage issues. We're careful about that, and we're currently put together a working group to, not unlike our wolf advisory group, but a black bear advisory group, to continue to look at the problem, evaluate if we're doing it right, how we can specifically target damaging animals or animals that are doing damage, and move forward in a way that we can humanely control specific problem bears, and at the same time alleviate this timber management damage. So,
yes. Many of us on the commission sat through the recent revision of the procedures and the rules that came from it. And one of the issues that always comes up in these damage situations and wildlife control is the use of non-lethal versus lethal. Can you talk mostly about, you know, when we get to the point of lethal, can you just elaborate a little bit on what has to be done to lead up to that?
Well, I think it's, you know, it depends on the individual situation. Many of these properties are huge, and so the challenge of, for example, using electric fences to keep bears out of large clear cuts is really difficult. That kind of that works great for beehives and honey with black bears. Electric fences do work really good for black bears. So, but it's a really big challenge. And you can do some hazing. Of course, we do all kinds of hazing involved in our dangerous wildlife programs. Our conservation officers have the Carilion bear dogs, where we, if we have bears that become habituated to residences, we capture them and then do what we call a hard release, which is maybe, you know, shooting the bears with a rubber bullet while you're release a Carilion bear dog on their tail and chase them out of the country, and it actually appears to work very well for some individuals. Black bears, or all bears, you'll find I have a bit of a bias, but they're extremely intelligent animals, and an easy food source is something that it's almost impossible for them to resist. And so the goal is to keep them from getting habituated in the first place. And how we manage and work with rural, not rural, but urban interface people to properly take care of their pet food and garbage and those things to keep bears from getting habituated in the first place is the best way to prevent that. But as far as the large timber properties, it's more difficult to do that kind of individual non-lethal control. You can do it, but remember, these are wild bears, and this is a source of food that in the springtime, when there's not much else to eat, the very high sugar content in sapwood is almost irresistible. So it's a food source, so it's pretty difficult.
And there again, being a tree farmer myself, but from the other side of the state where we don't do clear cuts, so this isn't part of our deal, but I do belong to the Washington Farm Forest Association and read their stuff all the time. Yes, we have the Weyerhaeusers of the world that it is a significant damage, but we also have the small producers to where if they've got a small plot and have bears come in and do some major damage, it is a significant economic impact. So granted, we are a Weyerhaeuser, owns a pile in the big timber companies, but we still have to keep the small guys in mind too, because this does have a significant damage to theirs. And Yeah, and Weyerhaeuser, they lose 5 acres of trees. Yeah, it sucks. But it, for a small guy, it's a big deal. So it's a tough issue. There's no doubt about it. And I think you guys are doing as good as you possibly can. And it does pain me that we have a suit pending or talking about it, because I'm afraid they're going to let the perfect become the enemy of the good. So,
well, hopefully we can work with folks and find a good solution to this. I actually misspoke on my numbers when I just I looked at my notes. It was in 1914 we had 144 animals, and we were down to 89. So I was off by a little bit. But we'll keep working on that one. It's I think it'll be good to bring people from all sides of that issue together, like we have with the wolf issues. So.
And there again, Eric was really good this morning about it, but we need to be careful how we're saying this, because they're not all large landowners.
Right, and okay. Yeah, in fact, we've had the small timber industry folks in here almost at every meeting in the last
regular basis.
2 or 3 years, so we know several of them by first name basis. So.
Well, and there again, that speaks volumes, because they were here on a regular basis, and then evidently we've got them to where they're happy with what's going on, and you hate to see this lawsuit destroy what we've worked to this point in time.
Just an interesting quick item. we're currently evaluating the use of drones to do some population monitoring of moose in northeast Washington. It's interesting to me. I did a lot of work on improving aerial survey methods, and drones have always, people have hoped that they would provide a great way to do some of our population estimation for big game, mainly because that's a very dangerous thing we do when we fly in helicopters and count things. And so this current study, we're evaluating number of moose calves, and we're associating that, doing the work with radio collared moose calves that we have, so that we can estimate the probability of sighting and a few things like that. So if you hear about that in Stevens, Ponderay, and Spokane County, that people are seeing drones flying over clear cuts or private timberland and Forest Service land, that's what we're up to. So,
mm-hmm. But that being said, with the wolf issues and all the things we have going up in that part of the world, let's get out in front of this and tell people that this is going to be going on and what you're trying to do, because we don't need the black helicopter effect going on. So yeah,
I appreciate that, and I'm reading from a news release that went out today.
Okay.
From Anana, but we'll have to get, you're right. People worry when things are flying. And part of the plan is not to fly over any houses or buildings or whatever. But
still, we're out in the woods. That's what we do for a living. We're outside. And I mean, when you start seeing drones fly over, yeah, it would be just really good to get out in front of this and just tell people what's going on, do your releases, so that you don't get a bunch of black helicopters going on.
Yeah, thanks for that. We'll try to get the word out best we can. Let's see. Commissioner McIsaac started to talk about southern resident killer whales. The department, governor's office, Puget Sound Partnership, and Ecology are all working together to put together a group to start talking about this in a bigger way. The killer whales have declined from 98 animals in 1995 down to 76 today. At a recent a meeting, the governor asked me what could we do to immediately do something for killer whales, and my thoughts, of course, went to increasing food sources, and Commissioner McIsaac was talking about doing a review of all of our hatchery production. That's something we've been working on for a while. I've wanted to increase hatchery production to alleviate the problems, just low population numbers where we could, to provide for recreational and commercial tribal fisheries. And so we've been doing some evaluations of where we're at in our hatchery production versus ESA, in Endangered Species Act constraints on that production, and also what part of that is a dollar problem, because it's both. Our budgets have declined over the last 30 years, and inflation has taken a big hit on hatchery production. Fish food is probably 10 times what it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And our department, we have 83 hatcheries around the state, and we have infrastructure problems in many of them, crumbling concrete, and some of them are not able to produce the capacity of the water that we have because just of infrastructure problems with the concrete and all of that. So we're doing an evaluation. Hopefully we can do something to increase hatchery production that will be helpful for killer whales as well as salmon in general and our recreational and commercial tribal use of those fish. Other problems associated with killer whales population declines are legacy and new toxins in the environment. Because these are long-lived animals, and many of these toxins reside in are fat soluble. They reside in the fat. They accumulate at this apex predator, maybe more than other animals, and so that's an important thing and for us to consider. And people, I don't know if people definitively know the impacts of those chemicals on production and whatnot, but it's certainly something we're looking at. Also, noise and vessel traffic has been identified. Our officers currently monitor whale watching operations, and there are rules and regulations about how close you can get to whales, and we're out there making sure that people follow those rules and don't harass the animals. But there's several things that we can do immediately to help, like increasing our enforcement efforts, hatchery production. Of course, that's down the road. If you started today, it'd be 3 years or 4 years before you really saw an impact there. Habitat restoration is an extremely important part of this equation. And whales don't just eat Chinook salmon. They eat a variety of salmon species. And when we replace a culvert, almost immediately, if it's in the right place, we get an uptick in wild production. A lot of those are coho, but it's important, and it's almost immediate. So I view that as kind of a short-term thing, and certainly replacing culverts that are blocking salmon habitat is something that we can do and get an immediate response. So other things, Commissioner McIsaac mentioned that there's also efforts on the Snake and Columbia River system. The new USV Oregon BIOP is evaluating increasing and maintaining high spill. That may help things. They're going to evaluate the Snake River dams, and we just did an evaluation of Mitchell Act hatchery production a year ago and reduced them to reduce the number of salmon on spawning grounds, hatchery influence on spawning grounds. And so I think we need to take a comprehensive look and decide what can we do and what the timeline would be, because some of the things you would do to reduce hatchery presence on salmon grounds kind of would run counter to just increasing production. So it's going to be a challenge, and lots of interesting topics and discussions into the future. And I did hear your request for a presentation in January, and we'll put together a more thorough discussion. In fact, there's a meeting going on today about southern resident killer whales with the state family led by the governor's office and some of our staff to work on what could we do. There's recovery plans for killer whales. There's recovery plans for Chinook salmon. And so there's a roadmap out there of what things to do. We don't need to reinvent those things, but we do need to figure out how we can do a better job on the federal and state levels to come together and move the dial, I guess, if you will. Next big item I wanted to discuss. Is the Puget Sound Chinook Resource Management Plan. Last Friday, we submitted this plan to NOAA. It's a plan that's been worked on over the last 6 months or more, actually more than that, since 2016. We've discussed this plan. It's actually a milestone and really important for us to come together on a longer-term plan with the co-managers, because it provides surety for coverage under the Endangered Species Act, as well as it helps the department in our North of Falcon negotiations because we don't have the need to secure approval from NOAA to hold our annual fisheries. So it's an important thing. I'm going to have Kyle Addicks come up and and also Mike Grossman, and they're going to help me on a couple issues. The Fish Committee had a pretty good discussion of this yesterday. The reality is we have some real abundance problems with natural origin Chinook salmon in Puget Sound. We're down 42% since listing. Some of the drainages are very impacted, and it's difficult and challenging. There's questions about what we can do there and what role harvest takes in those populations. And so Kyle's going to talk a little bit about some of the details, and I think probably touch on the Stillaguamish, which is one of the drainages that is highlighted by this management plan and will be restrictive in the future at low population levels. And Mike Grossman will talk a bit about just how we got here, what the process was, and what the future likes, and also maybe make a couple comments on how having a management plan like this helps us with our negotiations. So, Kyle, go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioners. Director Unsworth, for those of you who aren't familiar with our past Puget Sound Chinook resource management plans or haven't had a chance to read the new one over the last week or so, the core of the plan consists of 14 management unit profiles. Those profiles give background information and data on each of the management units and also identify the conservation objectives that will be used for those units. Many of the profiles in the new plan have similar conservation measures to prior plans, but some, like the Stillaguamish and Snohomish, are more restrictive. Both of those management units are important from an ESA perspective, and they're major contributors to the conservation and recovery of Puget Sound Chinook. As we reviewed the status of those management units, we concluded that additional conservation measures were needed to ensure their perpetuation and their ability to contribute to recovery. As Director Unsworth mentioned, the conservation objectives for Stillaguamish are likely to be among the most constraining in the updated plan. Under the new plan, the co-managers will use a proposed 24% limit on exploitation on Stillaguamish Chinook in all fisheries, so that's Alaska, British Columbia, and Washington. That rate is consistent with NOAA Fisheries' updated analysis and benchmark for a maximum fishery exploitation rate that poses a low risk to the Stillaguamish population. NOAA's 4D rule also requires that resource management plans take additional management actions at low abundances to reduce the risk of extirpation and prevent protracted periods of long abundance for the stocks. Consequently, the new plan proposes reducing exploitation rates in southern U.S. fisheries from 13% to 8% as abundances of Stillaguamish Chinook decline. 8% represents the average fishery exploitation rate we actually experienced in southern U.S. fisheries on Stillaguamish during the recent five-year period. We can't predict the future, but looking over the last 20 years, based on the observed abundances, we would have been in that 8% situation in three of the last 20 years, 15% of the time. Because the hatchery programs on the Stillaguamish are conservation programs intended to help perpetuate the Stillaguamish Chinook, the RMP also proposes to limit fishery exploitation rates on marked Chinook at lower abundances. So at abundances to the river of below 1,500, there would be an additional rate limit on hatchery origin Stillaguamish Chinook. That rate would be higher than the allowable rate on natural origin Chinook, and that difference between rates would decline from 6% to 4% as abundance declined from 1,500 to 900. To provide a little context, the average difference in the rates on marked and unmarked Stillaguamish Chinook during that same recent five-year period was around 5.5%. Not surprisingly, given the declines we've seen in Puget Sound Chinook, the plan will likely result in some additional restrictions to state and tribal fisheries in Puget Sound, especially in years when low abundances are expected. The degree of those restrictions will depend on the abundances of particular stocks, including Stillaguamish and others, in any given year. With that, maybe I'll turn to Mike Grossman, who's been instrumental in helping us navigate the permitting process, to talk a little bit about the mediation process and the NOAA's evaluation that will follow.
So good morning, Commissioners. It's nice to be with you again. Maybe I can sort of ask us to remember back to 2016. That was the year where we kind of had, I guess for lack of a better word, a bit of a meltdown in the co-manager North of Falcon process. We were a period of time where there was a lack of agreement and some real concern about how we crosswalk between what North of Falcon does in terms of allocating harvest opportunity, but also being able to undertake that, given the fact that all those fisheries impact listed Chinook and they need ESA protection in order to go forward. And I think you may recall, most of you at least, that that was a big stumbling block because we were getting annual evaluations. They were occurring after North of Falcon was done, and without that and without an agreement, we were essentially sitting on the beach for a while, and that was a really unpleasant place to be. We eventually managed to negotiate our ways out of that hole that year. But I think what it left everybody with is a real distaste for what happens if you have to do that kind of annual North of Falcon ESA crossover and you don't have something in place. And that's what an RMP really does. Under the Endangered Species Act, you can't incidentally or directly take listed Chinook without having some form of ESA protection. And NOAA's ESA Section 4D rules provide for a thing called an RMP, a resource management plan, which is a co-manager plan, meaning state and tribal agreed, that the co-managers then present to NOAA, and it essentially reflects a way to say, if we fish with these kinds of conservation constraints collectively, we think we can do those fisheries in a way that has minimal impact to Chinook and does not jeopardize them in the ESA sense. Once approved, a plan like that does provide the co-managers collectively with ESA take protection. And as Cal noted, we've had multi-year plans in the past. They've been 3 or 4 or 5 year plans. The last one was a 2010 plan that expired in 2014. We've been doing annual consultations since. The 2016 experience was bad, and frankly, there was some real concern that doing annual plans provided significant litigation risk. So one of the things that happened pretty immediately after the May-June meltdown and finally resolution was we got contacted by the Department of Justice and tribal attorneys and policymakers and said there's got to be a better way forward. And I think we all agreed that getting multi-year coverage on an RMP basis was the smart thing to do. And frankly, to take a little bit of time and also look at how the North of Falcon process works. What that led to was a request by the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States government and the tribes to do what's called a meet and confer. And this is a part of the continuing United States v. Washington jurisdiction where if there are issues that need to get resolved because we're running into problems, the court has retained jurisdiction and has required the parties to meet and discuss ways to get on a better path short of litigating the issue. One of the and so we had that issued to us, a request for us to meet and confer with the tribes and the federal government in October of 2016. That meet and confer took place, and those two issues were essentially identified as the important things to spend some time working on. Part of that court jurisdiction order provides for a mediation process as a way to resolve matters and try and use the court as a vehicle to try and get on a better path. And that was the outcome of that meet and confer, a request and a decision to use court ordered mediation as a means to get the parties together and on a planning process. And the number one priority was the RMP because it takes about 17 to 18 months to go through the NEPA process and the EIS process. We knew we wouldn't be able to do it for 2018, so this coming year we're going to be doing it on a continuing annual consultation. But we basically had a deadline of a submission of an RMP, co-manager RMP, by November 30th of this year in order to get one in place for the 2019 fishery. And so pursuant to that whole continuing court jurisdiction, we entered into a mediation process with Judge Peckman of the Western District Court acting as the mediator to negotiate an RMP. We finished that process just a couple weeks ago, and it was submitted to NOAA a week ago today. The mediation process does come with some restrictions. There are court rules that say things that are exchanged in mediation are confidential, and so we also had a court order saying Things that are received from the tribes are subject to a confidentiality requirement, and similarly, we benefited from being able to converse with the tribes on a confidentiality basis as well. I know that creates a certain tension for us because we live in a world where this agency and the agency I work for, the Attorney General's Office, embraces open governance. We have a Public Records Act. But at the same time, court mediation recognizes that in order to be successful, oftentimes parties need to be candid, they need to be open, they need to manage litigation risk, and so that's why the court rules mandate confidentiality, and in fact, our Public Records Act recognizes the utility of having confidential conversations and specifically exempts from public disclosure things that are shared in a mediation process. So this mediation was done on a confidential court-ordered basis. But what came out of it is the RMP, and the RMP itself is not a secret. Its terms are abundantly clear to anybody who can read it, and it is now going to be subjected to a process where NOAA will evaluate that as a public document in an open public record process that would essentially involve two components. There will be a NEPA process in which there will be a scoping period, alternatives will be looked at, an EIS will be generated, and there will be public comment associated with that particular process. There will also be an ESA evaluation in which NOAA essentially consults with itself to evaluate whether its approval of this permit that allows people to go forward and take, essentially incidentally take, listed salmon can be done in a manner that's consistent with the ESA. And that process, too, will have an opportunity for public comment and involvement as the agency evaluates the RMP and makes an initial determination about whether it's sufficient to continue on and be evaluated with a conclusion. It's a process that should run for about 17 months. We hope it'll be done in the April-May 2019 timeframe in order to be available for fisheries in that 2019 to 2020 period to be conducted under the auspices of this this RMP. And I think the director will probably be telling you that I'm sure you're going to want both some executive session discussion with us about the litigation aspects that drove some of this, but also I think a presentation to this commission probably at your next session in much more detail about all the implications. There will be a process during this period here, and I think during the next couple of months, where there's going to be ongoing dialogue with NOAA. We've already received some indications that some of the management unit profiles are going to need a harder look. Nooksack is one of them. They've told us, you know, it's actually too liberal. It probably needs to be a bit more conservative. So that's an example of some of the continuing dialogue that will go on to shape and further refine that resource management plan. Now, again, we aren't mediating with NOAA. NOAA has to make its own independent determinations, and so the conversations that the co-managers are going to have with NOAA going forward are going to be part of a public record and scrutinized, and as I said, there will be opportunities for public comment and involvement, as well as opportunities for the public to engage the commission and for the agency to engage the commission and discuss this as we go through this approval process through the next 17 months. The last remark I want to make, I guess, is, again, to talk about what's the value of an RMP. We can't fish without ESA protection. You know, we learned, sadly, in 2016 that the federal government has a view that they won't do an individual consultation for us like they do for the tribes and did for the tribes in 2016 under the BIA, consultation. So, really, this resource management plan is a co-manager plan or a unilateral plan, which would be very problematic, are the only two vehicles. And we made a decision to, after a lot of talk with you and with the agency, to proceed based on a co-manager plan. And once that plan's in place, I think it's one of the pieces that we identified that need to be in place in order for us to have a lot more secure conversations and to sort of recalibrate the negotiating posture that's available to us when we do North of Falcon annual. Because the RMP does not eliminate the need to do annual North of Falcon. The RMP acts as an umbrella of conservation constraints which the co-managers then need to live within. And the annual North of Falcon process then says, okay, within those collective conservation limits, how do we allocate and share the harvest opportunity that presents? And that's where we start evaluating what fisheries are available, what kind of an abundance level we're in, what are the conservation constraints that exist. And we will essentially negotiate on an annual basis how to distribute that conservation dimension across all the fisheries that all the co-managers want to pursue. So there's a lot more work to be done. There's a lot of work that we still need to do on, I think, in terms of developing how we work together in North of Falcon once we have the RMP. But it is a crucial piece that I think does recalibrate and puts us in a much better position to negotiate North of Falcon, not having to worry about whether or not we have ESA protection at the end of the day. The focus will then entirely be on, do we have a fair and balanced set of fisheries as between the various co-managers, knowing that we collectively have to live within these limits.
So I meant to add at the end of my remarks that if you haven't seen the plan and it has gone around by email, it is on the department's website, and we can get you guys the links to that if you'd like to see it.
What's the duration of this plan if once it's been vetted by NOAA?
So that's a great question. We're envisioning a 10-year plan, which will be one of the longer terms. You know, I think there's positives and negatives with that. 10 years, it's a long-term vision, but I think we learned that it took a year of intense court-mediated negotiations to get to a plan. If we did a short-term plan, I think what you'd find is relatively quickly after the new plan took place, we'd be back doing the same exact thing. That being said, you know, I think a lot can happen in 10 years. And so, for example, if new information comes in about killer whales and they're not, you know, we're not making progress, there would be probably a duty on the part of NOAA to reinitiate consultation. And if we learn things, you know, I think we can reinitiate consultation. At the end of the day, it's a co-manager plan. And so if the co-managers say this thing isn't working for us, we can go back to NOAA and have some more conversations with them as well. But the intent and the hope is that we'll get a 10-year plan and provide ourselves some room to work on a longer-term basis and not be scrambling constantly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of different questions for the gentleman here, but there was a discussion that perhaps this could get into greater detail in an ancillary executive session. So maybe I'll hold almost all of those for me. One question for Mr. Grossman, though. When you indicated that NOAA has indicated that perhaps the NOOCSAC provisions ought to be reconsidered because they're a little bit too liberal, if there's was NOAA part of this negotiation at all, and if they weren't, have they indicated any other areas that they would like to have reconsidered? And if the agreement is reconsidered for the NOOCSAC module, is it open for reconsideration for any of the other ones? And would that institute another forum like the one that just happened that resulted in the December 1 document?
So, good question. I think there were three components to it. So, first was NOAA involved. So, the people who were part of the mediation were essentially the federal government, the co-manager tribes, and the state of Washington. Early on in the process, we had some very good discussions about what can and can't NOAA do in terms of a mediation. And I think it was very clear from everybody's perspective that at the end of the day, under the Endangered Species Act, NOAA has a statutory obligation to make an independent decision and an evaluation that needs to be done on a record in order to be correctly done under the Federal Administrative Procedure Act. So their role was somewhat unique in the sense that they were there to provide a forum to ask questions and to provide some amount of guidance, but we were not mediating a decision made by NOAA. Instead, what we were engaged primarily in with regard to the RMP is reaching that agreement, because the RMP is a co-manager agreement that, once agreed upon, gets submitted to NOAA. So I think it's fair to say that NOAA's role was to be there and to be helpful in terms of answering questions, but their decision-making is now what's going to go forward, and that was not mediated. Now, I think the second question is, what does it mean to change potential pieces of this? I don't think it's uncommon when people submit a plan under Section 4D that there is some ongoing dialogue, because it's the evaluation that's done by NOAA, and to some degree the evaluation that's done by an applicant, is a sort of biological basis. It starts with biology, but there is a sort of policy dimension and a risk calculation that goes into that, because there aren't bright lines that the ESA does. What it means to jeopardize sounds very, or to not jeopardize sounds very simple. It is to essentially ensure that there's not an appreciable risk of the loss of a currently listed species, and there's not a lost opportunity to seek to recover that species. But how you engage in that sort of evaluation is, in some dimension, both hard science and also a sort of the art of risk analysis. So, you know, I think what NOAA is telling us is, when we look at this plan, this is what you're proposing to do, co-managers, we have some concerns, and they're giving us an early indication that they have some concerns about needing to be a little bit more restrictive on Nooksack. I'm not aware at this time about whether there are other management unit profiles of the 14 that they're going to take that same position on. That's part of the process that's going to go on here for the next month or two, and NOAA will be getting back to us. And when we do, we as co-manager are going to have to engage with them, and that'll all be on the record about how we make further adjustments to the management plans. I think principally NOAA's position will be, we'll let you know if you've not been conservative enough. I think people are going to ask, well, what happens if some of us think, you know, it's too conservative? That's certainly what we've been hearing from folks on the Stillaguamish. That's not the way NOAA normally approaches things, but I think given the stakes here, there might be some opportunity to have those conversations. It's not the normal kind of conversation that NOAA has, but it seems to me it can be part of the public commenting process, and then the question will be, you know, how does NOAA respond to that? Again, their perspective is, we're here to tell you whether your plan is conservative enough. They often don't find themselves in the position of saying, well, you could loosen it up. That's not typically how they approach things.
Okay, thank you.
You know, this is a pretty complicated issue, an important plan. The plan's over 300 pages. Please, I invite folks to get online and download the plan and take a look at it. I suggest maybe at the January commission meeting, we provide maybe an hour to go through this plan and look at these implications. And by that time, I think Kyle and his staff could do some modeling and some scenarios on how often that these very restrictive things would come into play. So I'm certainly willing to do that if the commission agrees that we should.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you fellows for the work you've put in and the oversight that you've provided us. It's been the most difficult for you and others, I'm sure. What I want to go over here is, I don't want to get into the detail, but I want to talk about I'm going to call it the Puget Sound Chinook Management Plan, just because that's old-fashioned in my mind. And Director, the Commission delegates authority to you on a variety of issues, and that's an appropriate thing to do. I mean, I agree with that. But I don't think it eliminates your responsibility to have consultation with us on issues of importance. And I certainly consider this Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan to be an issue of significant importance. So it's very critical, and not having direct discussions with the Commission, I think, is an unacceptable process. We're volunteers. We're here engaging with the public. We're here trying to make a difference. We're here to try and help. We were briefed at an executive commission meeting, and Mike and I spoke about it a few days ago, that I think it's fair to say at a very high level We didn't get into the details of this plan. We basically told there was a mediation ongoing, just enough to for us to try and read between the lines of what was really happening. We didn't know. And we got stakeholders calling us and emailing us and angst. You know, and I guess in closing, this is just my statement. Anybody else can do what they want with it. But we're a policy body. And if we don't have the facts, it's difficult to make significant policy decisions. And I feel like we were really, really left out on a limb on this one. I'm really not very happy about it.
Thank you. Other?
We had two other items on the director's report. They're in the written document. One is the progress made on the net pound evaluation, and that's on page 3 of the 11-page report. And also, there's a starting on page 2 is a Dungeness crab harvest report. The two people involved in that, Dan Routing, will you raise your hand? Dan is here today. And also, Bob Sizemore is here. He could talk about crab. I think because we have so many people present to testify, we'll let you read those reports. And if anyone in the audience came for those specific items, please talk to Bob and Ron, or Ron, yeah, before Rod, during the breaks or at other times, and they can help you with those issues. But with that, I'll conclude the report.
Thank you. And as the director said, we do have